This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is Johnny Owen, the film and documentary maker whose new series for BBC Sounds, Strike, chronicles the miners' strike in Britain, but specifically in South Wales. It's a new audio series made for Radio Wales, available across the UK on BBC Sounds. I'll put a link to it so that you can immediately start listening to it. Johnny is a fantastic storyteller, and whether it's fiction that he's made in the past or brilliant documentaries about football, one of which, of course, is about Nottingham Forest, I Believe in Miracles. He has a fantastic talent for bringing out the most interesting parts of the stories, often telling stories, or certainly about subject matter that other people may have tackled before, but doing it in a far more entertaining and accessible way. And his new series, Strike, is absolutely superb on BBC Sounds. So we've got a lot in common, but this is a brilliant interview about what made the strike different in South Wales than, say, Nottinghamshire or Yorkshire or even Scotland, and just about the legacy of the strike, the politics of it, the social cost, but a whole load of new things as well. Obviously, it's the 40th anniversary of the miners' strike, and there's a lot of stuff around this year. Johnny's take on it, Johnny's way of telling that story is entirely unique to him, and he makes it absolutely enthralling. So enjoy Johnny Owen. Johnny, your new series for BBC Wales and BBC Sounds is called Strike. It tells the personal story of the miners' strike. Obviously, it's the 40th anniversary this year, and there's a lot of documentaries out at the moment. What is it about your documentary that covers the strike in a different way?
It's a great question, Matt.
Thank you very much.
Why I took the job. It was one reason why I took the job, really. They wanted to do it from a Welsh perspective, which I always thought was really interesting, because I think that history has dictated that because the Notts, Yorkshire coalfields were borderline coalfields, and the big set pieces like Orgreave, etc., happened there, that people think the sort of the strike mostly happened there. But that was because of the clash of the different sort of, you know, the two philosophies of the coalfield really that developed during the strike. Yorkshire was obviously a little bit more militant, and it came out in strike and kind of aggressively picketed Notts out, or attempted to, and Notts had reacted against that. South Wales was kind of a coalfield to the periphery, in a sense, a bit like Scotland in the northeast. But I, ironically, Mick McGaughey, Arthur Scargill's famous right-hand man, said the strike will ultimately be won or lost in South Wales. And I think he was right on that. South Wales was the strongest area in the sense of the amount of miners that came out, and they were the strongest to the very end. I believe the figures are something like sort of 65%, even for Yorkshire, by the March of 85. But in South Wales, it was something like 98% was still out a year later. So it was something that was very personal to me. My father worked underground, my grandfather, my great-grandfather. It's not unusual in South Wales saying that, Matt, at all. It's the reason why we're here. It's one of the only coal fields that exists, you know, because of coal. In other areas, you did tend to have major cities and ports, like in the northeast, and like Newcastle or Lancashire, like Manchester, Milltown. South Wales was coal only. So I just thought it was interesting that finally somebody from a South Wales perspective wanted to do their interpretation of the strike, and they kind of let me have my own narrative on it, Matt, and sort of let me tell the story from my perspective, and that's, they've been as good as they were.
So why were South Wales miners effectively, you know, as you put it, I don't know if it's right to say more militant, but why is the percentage of miners that stayed on strike higher in South Wales than it was in Yorkshire? Is it because there were other employment options for people nearer big cities than there were in South Wales? Or is it something else?
Yeah, that's part of it. But I think in South Wales, historically, the way that the union developed with the communities, they were called the Fed before they became the NUM after the Second World War, where all the unions sort of joined together. There was the Spencer Union, for argument's sake, and the Notts Coalfield. It was called the Fed in South Wales. My grandfather and my great grandfather were all members. And it kind of like, it was almost central to South Walian life. The union was everywhere. You know, they built the miners' halls. Obviously, it was the main employment, and everybody was in the union. It was seen as more militant, certainly. But the reason for that was the pits in South Wales had the best quality coal in the world, Welsh steam coal. It had won the contract for the Royal Navy, and the Royal Navy obviously was the biggest navy in the world at that time, and other navies wanted to copy them, so they wanted Welsh coal as well. So it was kind of like, it was described by historians as the sort of Persian Gulf of its day, really. It was the main source of power for the world, South Wales. But the pits were really dangerous, Matt. They were deadly to an extent. The figures for mortality in Welsh pits were shocking to the modern sensibility. I mean, miners died at the rate of sort of like thousands, really, over the period of a month for years. And obviously other injuries as well. So they had to come together. The union was everything to them because the pits were so dangerous. So this it sort of engineered this solidarity, this kind of glue. And they were very clannish, you know. They lived in a very specific community that developed because of the coal fields. All those cliches like choirs and rugby and all that did develop as part of the community, all the Welsh stuff you hear about. So they had this kind of almost in their DNA loyalty to the union. And at the absolute center of that was what they call the picket line. So there was this belief that you absolutely cannot cross a picket line. I remember being a young boy and people laugh at this, and it's absolutely true. My grandfather telling me that to cross a picket line is worse than death. And you think to yourself, well, how can it be worse than death? But what he meant by that was, and I remember him saying to me, well, nobody will go to your funeral, see? And I remember being a kid going, oh my God, imagine nobody going to your funeral. So there's this almost like fanatical sort of belief in the picket line. And that, like I said earlier, is almost in the DNA of the South Walian mining community. And that permeated down the decades to the 80s. So you had this sort of idea that to sort of go back to work in any capacity once strike has been called and a picket line laid down was, you know, worse than death, really. There's amazing stories, Matt, of miners that crossed the picket line in the general strike or the great strike of 1926, sort of 27. And their graves are in their own part of the graveyard and things like that. There's been documentaries made about it, and nobody went to the funeral and all those kind of things. You know, they had to move away, others did. So you grew up with all these stories, and that was central to it all. So people would say they were much more militant in that sense. But I would say that as part of this history of really dangerous coal fields, it only being the source of employment, like you said, nothing else. There was no mill towns and things close to it. And like you're saying, the honouring of a picket line was absolutely central to how you lived and dictated, you know, how you worked as well.
What about the legacy on people's lives now? I mean, obviously, we know a lot of coalfield areas never really have recovered. Is there anything specific about the recovery or lack of it from the strike in South Wales?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I used to hear all the time. I was 13 when the strike went on, and one of the sort of the big slogans from people you'd hear who were on the side of the miners, and you know, that could be politicians and certainly from the Labour Party and people like Dennis Skinner would say, but what's going to happen to the valleys in the next 20, 30, 40 years? And that's what's happened. And the legacy is what we're living with now. My hometown of Merthyr Tydfil, where I am today, you know, it's one of the most socially deprived areas of Western Europe. That's just a fact. You know, they're always on sort of the tops of those awful tables, lack of chronic, you know, lack of work, you know, problems with drugs, criminality. Those are the legacies, because when you live in an area that's a one sort of employment town, which is what the South Wales Valleys were, once that work goes, it's very difficult to sort of replace that kind of work. And, you know, we weren't talking about thousands of people. We were talking about hundreds of thousands of people a century ago working in mining, tens of thousands by the time of the strike. But still, that's an awful lot of labour to replace, especially in a town like, say, Merthyr Tydfil, which is a population of about 60,000 people. If you think on the eve of the strike, I think there was something like four or five pits around, and the jobs attached to it, you know, the pits. Thousands of men worked in that industry, thousands. And so when that money goes, or sorry, when that employment goes, the money disappears, the wealth, the you know, the spending power, all those, you know, simple economic things, Matt. Like, you know, if somebody's earning at that time £100 a week, he's going to spend it. He's going to buy in the local shops. So all that gets taken away. And you know, there are awful problems in a lot of the valleys. The people are still here. They're amazing. You know, they've got that fantastic sense of humour. And you've spent time here yourself. You know, it's a wonderful place to sort of spend time. But the biggest problem is a lack of employment. And with that comes a lack of purpose. And then all those other things that spin off it, like a lack of money, lack of investment. The councils tend to be very poor. So it's all a legacy, really, of taking away that industry in such a brutal fashion. This is what I've argued in this. The gentle winding down of the mining industries in places like Germany and France, that was important. And we didn't do that after Thatcher won the strike. She was pretty brutal, really. I mean, there's that shocking figure of something like 30,000 Welsh miners on the eve of the strike. I think there was 250 left within 18 months. So those kind of figures are quite shocking to people.
What's people's view of the politics of 2024 applied to the miners' strike, particularly on things like the environment? I mean, in an accidental way, didn't Margaret Thatcher lead the way on climate change?
Well, I mean, Boris Johnson tried to argue that, didn't he? One of his, you know, there's a man with many outlandish sort of claims on history, and one of the more outlandish ones of them. I mean, you know, there is that argument. I don't think Margaret Thatcher cared really about clean energy when she got rid of the miners, or, you know, the union, certainly in the industry. I think it was, you know, a purely political thing, and for her over everything. I mean, Michael Heseltine, I've got some sort of grudge and admiration for him, because at least he said, look, it was political, it was never economical, as we, you know, argued at the time. We had to smash the most powerful union in the country. So, you know, I wouldn't put Margaret Thatcher's sort of like list of saying, oh, you know, it's all about the environment. Her plan was, you know, to confront the unions when they were ready. Or oh, everybody knows the famous stories. You know, she wanted to start in the spring. She stockpiled. She had incredible cooperation from the police, who were meant to be impartial, but we all know now that that didn't happen. There's certainly big set pieces like Orgreave. So, you know, it was, now you can talk to Tory ministers, and then, you know, they're honest. They say, look, you know, there was a plan put in place. We knew there was going to be a confrontation, and we knew we had to win. And they're very, you know, 40 years later, I suppose, it's like, you know, the releasing of documents 30 years later, they're a bit more upfront about it, I suppose, in the interviews I've had. And I'm intrigued to know, you know, what they were thinking behind the scenes and what they were doing. And it is quite fascinating, the amount of planning that went in on the government side on trying to beat the miners.
And have they been happy to talk to you about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've spoken to sort of people like Lord Hunt, and it'd be great. You know, I was very respectful. They were very respectful. We had sort of, you know, good conversations. You know, they say things like, you know, oh, you know, they were costing so much in government grants, and it was costing us millions. And obviously I'd go, yeah, but what about bailing out the bankers? We've done it before. And they go, oh, you know, so it's like thicker the narrative that suits them, in my opinion, is always sort of moved. You know, the goalposts change. So, you know, you do have those conversations. And listen, you know, there are, you know, real strong myths that are around the miners, you know, like that they brought the government down in 74. You know, that wasn't true. You know, they got into a, you know, they locked horns with Edward Heath over pay, and then he called a general election. He said, right, we'll go back to the country, and the country voted Labour. So, you hear people talking. I heard Michael Portillo the other day on television going, you know, the miners were bringing down democratic governments. They weren't. Edward Heath called the thing. But that narrative, it's been very interesting for me to find out about, you know, very, we think now, you know, trolling is terrible in the days of social media. In the mid 80s, I mean, the Red Tops were incredibly vicious. You know, I'm just being honest about it. You know, they went after the miners. And one of the most, I suppose, the one thing that has absolutely sort of informed me in doing this is I've realized, looking back at old newspapers, the miners now, you realize, were the conservatives with a small C. And what I mean by that is they were just fighting for their jobs, not pay or hours, and a way of living that had gone on a century. So they were actually quite conservative. They just wanted to keep their communities. Thatcher was the one who was kind of like, you know, free market economics, mass movement of labour, setting off of utilities, privatisation, all those things. She was the radical. Yet the irony was there was this narrative that the miners were kind of like these Stalinist, you know, fifth column agitators trying to bring the country down. It wasn't true. They were just fighting for their jobs and communities. And now, ironically, we've kind of got into this world where a lot of what we call the world's problems now, you know, chronic lack of housing, you know, extortionate sort of utilities bills, all began with Margaret Thatcher. And all I wanted to do was, like, I wanted to have the conversation. I wanted to say, look, there's this sort of feeling in documentaries and in the political historical space that the country needed Thatcher, and she gave the sort of the country that we needed, and we're living with it today. Well, my point is, well, history's not like that. Can we not argue with the fact that she freed the city up, who lost, you know, billions of pounds, that we're struggling now with our infrastructure on rail, that there were two recessions, there's been a housing market. Can we not chat about the fact that she got stuff wrong as well? But, you know, that's what I've tried to do with this. And it's been really interesting talking to people, certainly from the more conservative side with a large C of the spectrum will kind of go, and I'm going, well, you know, this is what happened under her. So it's been great in that sense of having the debate finally. And that's why I was so keen to do this series. And they've been very good about letting me do it.
The real heartbreaking legacy of the strike is that so many of those places that had those huge centres of employment and communities built around them for no other reason was housing plonked in those places other than to serve things like coal mines, had the mine taken away and nothing left in its place. And in some parts of Britain, that is still the case. And these communities are just sort of left there on their own. What do they say to you? And what is effectively the Thatcherite view on why they weren't more proactive in trying to replace coal mines with at least some other form of meaningful employment?
Yeah, I think what you had was, you had this feeling of, you know, picking yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, I mean, we did get into Britain, which I think is remarkable now, almost fantastical sort of like conversation that people were listening to. I'll give you an example. Norman Tebbit famously said, my father didn't, you know, riot or join you. He got on his bike and got to... And I can remember my father sitting at the time going, what, 30,000 miners cycling down the M4 looking for work? I mean, that was the kind of talk that people were taking seriously. You know, yeah. It's almost laughable to us now, but that's, and people would listen and cheer, you know, quite right. So there was such a detachment from that world. George Orwell said a wonderful thing once. He said, the problem with the mining industry is, he said, there's no coal in Hyde Park. And it's a great line because he said, like, those communities are so far away sometimes from London and sort of that political world, South Wales, the North East, but they had no real understanding of how important that industry was and the culture that came with it. So I think there was a sort of a real clash of cultures there, of people going, look, we need to modernise, we need to sort of, you know, de-escalate some of the union power, which I wouldn't argue with in some respects. You know, there was some certainly modernisation that needed to happen in the nationalised industries and things like that. There's not even an argument for me from that. But I think what I've sort of always said is, it's the brutal smashing of the industry, the smashing of the unions. And that's the reason why we've ended up today for me with, you know, 0 hour contracts and this, you know, this sort of, you know, it was an actual policy by Sir Keith Joseph, you know, this reserve army of labour, he called it, you know, it's keep some people on the dole, keep some people scared, you know, sort of allow sort of, you know, people to come into the country, and because it keeps people scared and divided. And you see it all now, you know, the miners were the enemy in the mid 80s. Now it's all about immigration. There's always a narrative from people to try and keep other people frightened and point to them, going, got to be careful of them. Make sure you've got what, you know, you've got, but watch them. And that was always there even then, you know. Like I said, to talk about the way the press were at the time, it's fascinating for me to see so many parallels you could bring to modern history that you see at the time, you know, and how, for me, some of the problems we've got now started with certain people driving a certain narrative and allowing other people to believe it. Like I said, Tebbit's the perfect example. Get on your bike and look for a job. What a ridiculous thing to say to a village where 5,000 people are employed in one industry and that's gone now. You know, it was just, that's where we were living though at the time.
You mentioned the relationship with Red Tops. Obviously, Liverpool as a city is a really good example of how an area's relationship with even just one arm of the media can completely break down, and that still has a legacy, a proud legacy, 40 years later. Does the same thing exist in South Wales? Do people still not buy the Sun? Has it changed people's perception of the police even to this day?
I believe that the Sun and Tilwa, the dreadful, you know, thing that happened in Hillsborough, had its poorest sales in South Wales. That's what I'm sort of, everybody read the Daily Mirror famously in Wales. That was the sort of belief. I think you're right. I think the miners' strike was the first step in Britain of where we've ended up now, with people talking about, you know, the MSM, where people go, I don't trust the media. I genuinely think, and I've spoken to a lot of people, that started with the miners' strike. Certainly the miners that were there and their families say this, you know, they've never trusted the government. And I think one of the saddest things, Matt, that I felt at 13, 14, and a miner said to me, Neil Lewis, he said, he was 19, 20 during the strike. These were young men. And he said, what I realised after the strike, he said, was that there are things out of my control. I thought all my life, living in a democracy in Britain, if I did things and I worked hard and I was good at my job, you know, I would be kind of looked after. That there was this kind of almost benevolence amongst the political caste in Britain, where there was a belief that you were kind of looked after, that people were doing things for the right reasons who ran everything. And after the strike, he said, I realised ultimately that I'm not in control of my own life. You know, the big wheels keep on turning, the big, you know, decisions that are made, that can affect you economically are beyond my control, beyond my power. And I thought that was incredibly powerful that he said that, and he learned that at 19, 20, that ultimately, you know, there are world events that you can't control, that you think you're going to be able to sort of affect and, you know, look after your own sort of life, but that can't happen. And I thought that was incredibly poignant. And I realized that that's what happened to me. I was 13, 14 when it happened. I didn't think we could lose because the naivety of thinking, well, they're just striking for their jobs. Who could be against that? And then when the miners lost, and they did lose quite devastatingly, and that, this is the big thing, Thatcher, I believe, during 84, would have been, you know, was looking to win. But by the early part of 85, she was like a boxer, really, in the sense that she realized she could deliver a knockout blow, and she went for it. She decimated the industry and the union. And there was some incredibly more poignant stuff of miners telling me that when they went back to work in the 85, the management were like really, really ruthless to them, spoke to them a certain way, told them the pit was being shut. Awful stuff like saying to Welsh miners, either we've got a month to take your redundancy or you don't get it. So miners were like, oh God, we'll have to take this, otherwise we won't get anything. You know, the whole atmosphere changed after that. It was almost like she'd won and she was going to absolutely sort of screw them into the ground. And the other really interesting thing that I found out was I spoke to Neil Kinnock, who I like enormously. I get on really well with Neil and he's always been great to me. But we were talking about this and there was always been this cordial agreement since the Second World War, maybe even before, that the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition would sort of share security, you know, with one another because it was just seen as a thing to do. And Thatcher never involved him once. He was never invited to one single meeting. And as soon as she went, John Major started again with Cornelia. You know, you need to come in and you need to be part of this stuff on Northern Ireland. And it's continued ever since. And I just thought, God, that kind of sums her up, doesn't it? This absolute ironclad belief that what she was doing was right. You know, the Iron Lady was like, I don't even want to hear anybody else's opinion. This is what I'm going to do. This is what's going to happen. And I don't care. It was just a bit like, to have that kind of ego and belief in yourself is, it's almost like, you know, now you kind of go, I can't believe that actually happened, but it did.
Oh, I can believe it. And I could well believe it would happen again. But you're an experienced documentary maker, an experienced storyteller. So how have you chosen to break this series down? Is it chronological? Or does it follow certain individuals?
What I've done is I've tried to be really fair and speak to everybody and ask for their own opinion and things. So I think I'm in a kind of a unique position in that obviously I'm from a mining family and background, you know, because that's where Merthyr Tydfil is in the valleys. But I live in Nottingham now and I dearly love that city and its people. They've been amazing to me. And I know people there and that I get on brilliant with who works with the strike. So I think that's been fascinating to me because, you know, my father used to call it the S word. We've got an episode called the S word. He wouldn't say it, you know. And everybody had their own experience of that strike. And I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to speak to Notts miners and say, well, why did you work? You know, what was the difference here? And you get some, you know, incredible stories about like how Notts was just different. It wasn't as militant. They had a bigger sort of, they had bigger pits. They were much more like cathedrals. Welsh miners talked about it. They were paid better. They didn't want to strike, you know. So there was all these really interesting factors that make it such an interesting story that I wouldn't have known about. I just was like, at 30, and why aren't they working up there? Well, you know, there were reasons for it. So that was fascinating to find that out. And I have gone chronologically, but I've tried to sort of, you know, really get under the skin of like why people made certain decisions. Because ultimately, the miners' strike was about two giant characters and sort of political sort of, you know, heavyweights smashing into one another in Scargill and Thatcher. But sadly, the fallout of that, certainly on the miners' strike, was, you know, felt very real by families and communities right across Britain. And I just wanted to talk to them and find out how they felt. Because they're so proud. Like, I can talk about South Wales, for argument's sake, and, you know, and say the North East. But even now they'll go, oh, you know, we produced Nye Bevan and Tom Jones's father was a miner. Burton's father was a miner. You know, the Charlton brothers' father was a miner. And they won World Cups. And Lynn Davis, who was Olympic gold medal winner. And they've all got this kind of like, we knew our place in the world. We were an important people. You know, D.H. Lawrence is from the Notts Coalfield. They kind of like, there was a real pride that they produced real heavyweight players on the world stage, politically, artistically, in a sporting sense. And like, you kind of realize that, you know, these people were really proud of what they did. It sounds incredible to a modern era to go, well, they were proud of going in a hole in the ground, digging out coal. And you go, yes, They really were. They were dead proud to go down there to do honest work. You know, they used to say things to me like, we heat the hospitals and the schools were cold, you know. Churchill mentioned us after the Second World War, and we mentioned the fact that we produced record amounts of coal for the war effort. So it's really important to sort of say to a modern generation, these weren't just like people that worked in almost like a Dickensian industry. They were people that really, really knew their place in the world. I'm really proud.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
And do you think, along with it, with the erosion of the coalfield, has changed people's patriotism at all, or their sense of national or local identity? I mean, I guess locally it has, but does it feed at all into people's sense of Welshness or Britishness?
Yeah, I think so. I think especially, I mean, the high watermark of Welsh history for a lot of people in the modern Welsh history was 1913, you know, the eve of the First World War. Nobody could have envisaged what happened. You know, there's a great historian, Peter Stead, who said that you'd come off Cardiff Central, magnificent station, walk through, you know, St. Mary's Street in Cardiff, all these buildings, you know, there were coal trams coming past you, heading to the docks. He said, like, you know, every Welsh historian would have wanted to walk up St. Mary's Street in 1913. This was like the high water tide of South Wales coal field. You know, you had the coal, first £1 million check, and then he said you'd have gone up the valleys, terraced houses, full employment, giant miners' institutes, full of libraries and places to read, and, you know, sort of like this theatres. So it's like you realise there's this like, you know, society that really understands what it is, you know, who they are. You know, I keep coming back to it. They knew their sense, you know, of where they were in the world. And I'm fascinated by that, because now we're kind of living... I was thinking, if South Wales had 250,000 miners, right, in the 1920s, just before the first real depression rather than a recession, and now there's none. It's an incredible thought, isn't it? And I don't know anywhere else in the world, other than possibly, and we had this chat, and they were like, cowboys in the American West, that had that sort of almost reversal. And if you think of it, the cowboy in the West is an almost mythical figure in Western. So the miner has become like that for people like me and you. We go, oh, these were industrial men. It's like, they're almost like they belong to another age. What were they? What made them that? You know, there were millions of them across Britain. They famously fired out Royal Navy that fired the Empire. They were really proud of being British. My father was in the British Army, and he was livid. They were called the enemy within, and not just livid. It was the injustice. So it was that anger of like, how dare she say that? You know, we fought in the wars. You know, this idea that we're the enemy within, that's the miners. And those kind of words really cut deep and still do. They all still talk about it, that, you know, she said that about us, you know. And they do these great things. They go, her husband, he was in South Africa. He was dealing with South Africa. Her father never fought in the Second World War. He was a shopkeeper in Grantham. You really get that visceral feel of like, we were British. We were proud of being British. And they called us the enemy within. We built the bloody empire. With it, you know, we fed their ships. You get that, Matt, which I find really fascinating. You know, don't think the miners were these nutty socialist sort of like lefties. That's not the truth. The miners were really, really proud of who they were in the British Empire. And now, with the, you know, the modern world, the way things, you go, really, they were. Yeah, they were. They you know, they worked hard. They produced something which was really important to the world. They built these amazing communities. And as far as they were concerned, they were the most important industrial workers in Britain. That great line by Richard Burton, he calls them, you know, they were the Roman guard, basically, of the Praetorian guard of the working class the kings of the underworld. He said they walked in a certain way. So I was fascinated to find all that kind of stuff out, because it's much more complex than people realize, where they just think they were a bunch of sort of unionist lefties. They really weren't. They were, a lot of them were royalists. You know, a lot of them really cared about, you know, the union. You know, there's all that kind of stuff going on as well, which, you know, I thought was really interesting to find out about.
What about young people in South Wales now? Are they aware of that history? And either way, are they bothered?
Another great question.
I think you might not have covered it in the series, so I don't know.
No. I think we all kind of grow up aware that where we're from. I'm, because I'm in my mid 50s coming up to now, and
you look good on it.
We did ask. Well, we did ask a question in my local pub called the Red Lion in Hilgerig in Merthyr. Hilgerig was a pit village in Merthyr. And it was very interesting that but these were mates in their 40s and 50s. They all went, well, at least a father or a grandfather worked underground. Like I said, not unusual. And they all said, oh, I probably would have gone underground. And there's this kind of lament, almost like a melancholy, where a few of them have had to move away and said, it's quite sad, really, because when we get together, we have a few pints and we all end up laughing. And one or two of them have said, I would have loved to have done this like our grandfathers. I would like to have, you know, worked with everybody and had a pint and seen one another. And you can see then why they were so incredibly close, why these communities were absolutely rock solid, you know, that why they kind of moved there and stayed there in what people would now say was sort of like such a brutal industry, that there's a kind of a spirit of corps, they call it, very similar to what some soldiers talk about who served miners, course, sort of go, it's hard to explain, but once you've been underground, you can't have sort of office politics down there. They were like, you just couldn't, because you could die. And there was one miner called Neil Lewis, Lukey I mentioned earlier. He was 19 and he was just talking very sort of like matter of factly. So I had to mature very quickly. And he said, by the time I was down to a year, 18 months, I was put on picking duties. And I immediately went, well, what was picking? And he went, well, what used to happen? Two men were working on the coal face and a head in. They would work until it collapsed. I was like, sorry, this is like the 80s, yeah. And he said, my job was to watch the roof. And if it started picking, I would shout to them and get them out, because we knew it would collapse. And I was like, so your job at 19 was to make sure a roof didn't collapse on some men? He went, yes. And I was like, okay, that's why you were so close. That's why you had to get on with each other. And that's what made the miners extraordinary.
There must be part of you, as proud as you are of your family heritage in the industry and of the area itself, you must be delighted you don't have to work down a pit.
You know, it always makes people laugh, this. I must have been in my early 20s and, like, you know, full of myself. And I kind of said, you know, I might have even been working. I was certainly in a band on telly. And I went, oh, I know, I'd have gone underground a generation ago, only 20. And my father kind of wryly looked up and said, you wouldn't have gone underground. You'd have been one of the mouthy union reps. And I was like, I think I probably would have, actually, yeah. And he had a great point, you know. And I do think that do you know what I do, which will make you laugh? I have been underground a few times, because I worked on the Tower, Last Pit in Wales, some documentary series. And I was determined not to show any kind of nerves or anything when I went underground. And I went down the shaft and I walked around for a bit. So in my head, I was thinking, you can't let your ancestors down here. Do you know what I mean? Because you can't go. So I went down. And interestingly enough, only me and one other person, because we didn't take a camera down, because obviously you've got to take special cameras down. Only one other person wanted to come down with us, but I did it. And they all talk about this story of, they all talk about the first day. So the first day, when you go underground, my grandchild would be 14. My father was like 15, 16. All the old miners used to sort of mess around with them and go, ooh, and if it dropped, and they did it. So they'd test them. And really interesting, like Lukey, the miner, and Stuart Buxton, Boo from Nottingham, they both talk about their first day about the other miners sort of playing with them. So that's a big part of it, Matt. It's a great question, because what you've got is almost like a test of like your masculinity in that sense. It was a very macho sort of, it was a male-only world. They were tough men, you know, had to be. A lot of them got, you know, diseases, but they just got on with it, you know. So there was a lot of that sort of bravado you had to have underground, which, I, you know, fascinates me. I'll quickly tell a great story about my grandson, my mother's father. So his first day underground, he would have been 14. and his mother knitted him a wool jumper to go under. And his father worked there. And his father was in the cage with him, working with him. So you can imagine, this is his son. And one of the old miners went, oh, you can't wear that underground, son, you'd be too hot. And they used to have nails on the wall. They used to hang things up, and they used to put their cigarettes in the brickwork. So when they come up, they could all find where there was. So he hung his jumper up first day. He goes underground. He has his first day underground. He comes up. He's like 14. This is like, you know, in the early 20s, in the 20s. And he comes up, and they'd undone his jumper and put it perfectly back into a ball of wool and put it back on the thing. So he has to go home to his mother, my great-grandmother, who's been knitting it all, like, you know, ready for him, and go, sorry, ma'am, they've under... And apparently my great-grandmother, she bollocked my great... Why did you let him do this? And he was like, well, it's part of it. The boy's got to learn, do you know what I mean?
Bullying is an important part of the workplace.
Yeah, this is where he, this is where he becomes a man.
So, Johnny, you've made various different types of shows. Svengali, which was a fictional show that you wrote about a guy in a band. You've made factual documentaries like I Believe in Miracles and Three Kings and Don't Take Me Home about football, and now you're making an audio documentary about the miners' strike. Are you more drawn to effectively true stories than creating fiction now?
I think so, yeah. I think, obviously, doing I Believe in Miracles was a game changer for me. In the fact that it was just really successful commercially and critically, which is obviously the dream for anybody. And it kind of opened up that space for me really to do more stuff and to get more offers. As I often say, if you make people a bit of money, they ask you to do something else, and I hope you make a bit more money. So yeah, that was great really. And that was really freeing for me to do that. And I think I've kind of got to a stage now in my, I hate to say career, but in my life, I'd say, where I do like to do things that are interesting to me. So I've ended up making a few Wales films, documentaries on the football team. And obviously the miners' strike one was obviously very, I was very keen to do it as soon as they offered it to me, really. Especially, you know, with the proviso of what they wanted to, what story they wanted to tell and how they wanted to tell it. There were also some people involved. There's a producer called Claire Hudson, who I'd admired from afar for many years in Merthyr when I was sort of working for HTV. And then, you know, she was at BBC at the time, great journalist. And she's involved on this, and she's been brilliant to work with. So I was keen to work with her. So, you know, you're always good. You always want to be working with different and interesting people and doing interesting things. And like you said, I'm very lucky, Matt, and I've got to a stage where I can not pick and choose, but mostly do things that I really, really want to do, which, you know, makes me incredibly lucky, really.
When you were describing the scene down a coal mine, I had Lee Anderson on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he was describing just how brutal it was down there, often men up to their waist in water and the heat and everything. A lot of this sounds very cinematic, and obviously it's a dramatic backdrop. You could see how it would make a fantastic setting for a film, actually down a coal mine, and how scary that would be in a lot of the things. I mean, do you think there would be an appetite, not from audiences, because I think there would be, but from film or TV producers to make a really high-quality miners' strike drama set in a pit?
Yeah, I'd love to do one. I've always dreamt of doing one about the creation of a pit village, really, in South Wales, but because I'm so fascinated about what we spoke about, that nothing existed there before. You know, they were always sort of like the industrial towns that developed. You know, certainly Liverpool and Manchester were ancient parishes, really. So there was always a sort of like an idea there was a settlement there that suddenly grew because of this sort of like, you know, thirst for sort of industry. But South Wales was almost unique in that it was much more similar to sort of the American West, the Wild West. There was nobody there. You know, it just the raw materials and the conditions to, you know, to coal and to make iron and all those kind of things. I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by the fact that the South Wales mining communities were created from scratch. That Merthyr's a great example. Merthyr was literally just a few scattered farms. And then suddenly there's like 50,000 people there within 40 years. Just go, what happened there? You know, it's like with the local farmers sort of like incredible breeders, no? It's just a pipe. You know, piled in from across Europe, really. And I think there's an amazing story to be told. What I found out, Matt, as well, which has fascinated me, was agricultural work wasn't just really, really difficult, you know, backbreaking, literally, but really badly paid. So people were kind of tied to the land in a lot of respects. And I know there's sort of like amazing historical moments and sort of like upheaval, like the Black Death. Apparently, the irony of the Black Death was that for the first time people were able to bargain the labour because there just weren't enough people. So for the first time, you could say to the local baron, "I'm not going to do that. I'm going to have to pay me for that." So these things created an environment, and the Industrial Revolution had touched, well, very much had a touch of that, in the sense that if you were living in sort of rural Wales at that time, you know, you lived in a really sort of crabby parish where there was backbreaking work, very little land, you know, the land was hard to work. Suddenly these sort of pit villages opened up, and people forget, you know, they were really lucrative. They were well paid. The housing was really good in comparison to sort of like, you know, these, the farmhouses that was sort of across Wales, these miners' cottages. They were incredibly interesting and exciting. They had pubs. You could meet people from the opposite sex. You know, so, you know, there were all these other things that you just think, why would you go into an industry like that? But actually, the communities that created were actually much more lucrative than working in, you know, where you had been in sort of West Wales. And also you had a chance of meeting somebody. The churches sprang up, you know, pubs, miners' institutes, theatres. So all these things sort of sprang into life. And this community was created. I thought, what a great drama that would be. Imagine starting the drama with like a pickaxe going into like sodden turf. And some sort of industrialist has come from London going, I'm sinking a pit here because I've heard there's a seam of coal. And, you know, Reece Evans is there and he's boom, boom, I'll be able to sort of dig the coal mine. I think there's a great story to be told of how that developed and how that world developed, really.
And thinking about the stories that you've told in this new series for BBC Sounds, are there things that you left out that you wish you could have included? Are there things that maybe weren't appropriate for whatever narrative you've chosen?
No, I think we've been pretty good. I would like to have done more of the geographical sort of things. I mean, South Wales was obviously where I come from, and the way we have attacked the stories. I think there's a fascinating story to be told from Scotland and the northeast, you know, those different mining areas. Do you know there were Kent miners? Have you heard this? There was a little coal field in Kent. People was really garden of England, absolutely. And this is a fascinating thing. So what happened was the more militant people in the coal fields in the 30s, especially, you know, in 20s and 30s, especially in South Wales and Yorkshire, they were sent to Kent. So the Kent miners, by the time the 80s came, were the grandsons of all these sort of militant miners. So they never had one single person who went back to work. Isn't that extraordinary? So the Kent coalfield came out and not one. So they became quite famous. So a lot of miners sort of across the country, well, then the Kent boys turned up and they were brilliant. And I was like, oh, I'd love to do a story about the Kent miners. Where are they now? What happened to them? The fact they shut the coalfield down when the strike ended is so sad. You know, not one of them went back to work, but none of them broke the strike. Who were they? Why were they there? Who were their grandfathers who came from South Wales? And, you know, what do you have to do in South Wales to be kicked out for being too militant? South Wales, like, do you know what I mean? Like, you must have been a lunatic. So I would, those kind of, the angles of attack tell the story, as they say. I would love to do a multi-part sort of thing, looking back maybe in time, where you could tell the story from each coalfield's perspective, because obviously Lancashire would have had a very specific story. Scotland, as I said, northeast, Notts had a very... I think Notts and Yorkshire's story has been told many, many times, quite rightly, because it was kind of the front line of the strike in many respects. But I think there's other coalfields. Scotland is fascinating because Scotland actually started the strike in many sense. People always talk about Cortonwood was the Yorkshire pit they shut to really sort of to get Scargill to react, really. The year before they'd shut Lewis Merthyr, and the Welsh miners had sort of gone to the rest of the coalfield and said, look, we're going to shut Lewis Merthyr, a really famous pit in the Rhondda. And they voted not to. They voted not to come out. And the Welsh miners were really annoyed about this. They were really aggrieved. And of all the pits, apparently Cortonwood was the one that gave them short thrift. No, we're not coming out. A year later, Cortonwood gets shut and everybody comes out. A Scottish pit, Monkton, I think it was called. There's a pit in Scotland that started it. That's the irony. People think it started in Yorkshire. It didn't. It started with a Scottish pit. They started picketing out a few days before. Then Cortonwood was mentioned. And it was a shock, Cortonwood, because Cortonwood was seen as a modern pit, a lot of coal, economically viable. When they said they were going to shut it, that really was, it was almost like a challenge to Scargill. And people forget about Scargill. I mean, he gets a bad press, but people have to remember, he was voted in as leader of the NUM, which was the biggest and most powerful union, certainly in Western Europe, and the most famous, arguably, in the world with the Teamsters, was the NUM. He was voted on a mandate of that he would fight pit closures. That's why he was voted in. He went, I will fight pit closures, tooth and nail. And of course, they started shutting pits down and they leaked this famous document of pit closures very cleverly to the press. And he had to say, I'm going to have to go on strike now. And now you get people like, as I mentioned, with Michael Portillo going, oh, it was stupidly planned. And we, you know, he came out at a stupid time. he had to come out to that point. He was under huge pressure from, you know, areas of the NUM to say, if we don't make a stand now, then we're in real trouble. And what's most, one of the most interesting things as well, Matt, was every single mind that I've spoken to was struck from every single part of Britain. None of them regret doing it. Not one single mind has said to me, I'm sorry, I wish I hadn't done it. They all say, I'm so glad we did it. I'm so glad we went down swinging. One from South Wales, over there on the day before yesterday, had a tattoo of a miner's lamp and the dates and the strike. It absolutely defines them. In fact, they almost get prouder every decade. They almost go, I'm glad I did it. I'm glad we made a stand. I'm glad we didn't go meekly. I'm glad we didn't go gentle into that good night, as Dylan said. I'm very glad they made a stand. And I thought that was really interesting.
Obviously, a lot of your films are about football. Do you think, I mean, football's always given people a sense of identity and place and pride. The sorts of things you were discussing that coal mines gave people. When you think of how deindustrialized Britain now is football the last thing really that gives people that sense?
Yeah, I think it's the last sort of genuinely working class sort of boxing is a bit still, I think, but obviously we don't box in the same numbers anymore because parents don't want the kids to go in the ring. I understand that rugby is even starting to turn that way. Football's still a sport that's seen as very safe. And the vast majority is, you know, sort of become professional tend to be from very working class and sometimes even underclass backgrounds. And I think that's something really important, that it's a game of the people still. I mean, listen, it's incredible. It's a wash with money. It's a super rich sport, especially obviously the Premier League, which has become a phenomenon. No two ways about it. But I still think like the vast majority of those players, even from across Europe, they tend to be sort of from more, you know, sort of less money backgrounds. There's a famous saying, and then my father used to say it, that they don't produce many heavyweight boxing champions from Eton. You know, it's a great point, isn't it? You know, if you go to public school, you don't have to do these sort of fight out in a certain way to try and sort of break out into, you know, I earn some money in many respects. And I think football has that. I think football's still very much, you know, played by anybody. There's a wonderful line somebody said once about, I think it was on about Rivellino. And then they were talking about a modern Brazilian footballer, somebody from the 90s, and he said he's got a touch of the favelas about him. You know, he had a slightly sunken jaw, and he had his teeth done, and there was still this feeling that a lot of the Brazilian players come from really deprived backgrounds, and that drives them forward into becoming, you know, sort of like world superstars. And I think football still has that. I think that's the romance of football in a lot of respects. It's like somebody can come from, you know, a very ordinary background and become something huge. And, you know, listen, we smashed them, and you know, Paul Gascoigne's a great example for me. Come from a council estate in Newcastle, had this genius about him, and you know, but I still think there's a lot of affection for someone like Gascoigne. Even Gareth Bale. Gareth Bale's father was a caretaker in Whitchurch in school, and Gareth came from an ordinary background, and everybody's really proud of being Gareth. I heard somebody mention the other night that he's my favourite Welshman ever, and I was a bit like, what? Even more than I? He was like, yeah, I think Gareth Bale is the most important Welshman. One of the most important Welshmen ever. And I could see what he was saying, because on a world stage, it's like people, you know, and recognise your country. And Burton had this effect, obviously Tom Jones and people like that. But it's really interesting that football can give us heroes that we aspire to and we admire them because they come from nothing. There's nothing more, I don't think, admirable for me in the world than a self-made man or woman. There's something about that. You know, there's something about somebody that comes from nothing and creates and achieves something. And that doesn't have to be in an economic sense, Matt, of somebody who becomes a... Like, it's somebody in sport. I think it taps into something very sort of basic in us as human beings, the warrior thing. You know, as tribes, when we grow, we had to sort of like domesticize animals and crops, and then they could get stolen. So you had to have sort of the tough people in your tribe to look after you. And they became really important in all aspects of human sort of like, you know, history right across every continent. Your warriors in every tribe and every people are always admired. And I think footballers, like boxers, are our modern day sort of warriors, athletes, people we look up to as kind of like, we wish we were them. I think if I said to you and me, we had a reset and we were standing with the creator, whether it be God or the universe, and went, you can come back as anything. We both go, I want to come back as footballers, and I want to score the winning goal for Cardiff City or Merthyr or Nottingham Forest in the Cup final. And I want to score the winning goal for England and Wales. We would do that. If that was a choice on the menu, I think we'd pick that first.
Well, I was going to finish by asking you what your next series or film would ideally be about.
Yes, great. I mean, I am doing something that I think would really interest you. I mean, I'm doing something. It was a bit, the concept was my idea. My wife is Vicky McClure, the actor, great friend of you, as you know, a fellow Nottinghamian. What would you say? Nottinghamite? How would you describe someone from Nottingham?
Just someone from Nottingham.
A Notts bird. Should we say that?
Notts bird.
So she's a very proud Notts girl.
A Notts duck.
Notts duck, yes. Absolutely. We're doing something which she gets elected to Parliament, which I think is fascinating. It's called Reluctant Politician, on like a popular issue. And then that world of Parliament, this is something that me and you have very much got in common. I'm obsessed with the political world, the world of Parliament and how it operates and the history of it, and sort of how fascinating it is when you get in there and scratch the surface of how Parliament operates. You know, they call it the mother of parliaments, and you know, something really, really interesting for me and all that. So that's kind of like what I'd like to do sort of next, if we possibly can. I'm really interested in doing that. And obviously this will make you laugh. If Wales qualified for the Euros, then I'd be interested in sort of doing something about that. Matt just
raised his hand. Why are you laughing at that? I want you to qualify.
I know. Yeah, but I would like to do something around that. I think for Wales to qualify possibly four times in 8 years after never qualifying since 1958 needs to be talked about, really, is like what happened in Wales. And I know you'll say that we got in a lot of English lads with Welsh ancestry.
That's great. I think it's great that England could qualify twice. As England and as Wales, I think it would, don't we get more coefficient points for that? So, I'm pulling your legs, and that winds you up. I don't think that at all. I think lots of these lads from Nottingham have a proud Welsh heritage.
Oh, it's great bands, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Johnny, thank you so much.
Oh, mate, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, there you go, Johnny Owen. And what sets him apart is he's not just a documentary maker, he's a fantastic storyteller. And that's what brings subject matter to life, makes it more entertaining and more memorable. And his new series on BBC Sound, Strike, which, as I said at the start, you can click on the link right now and listen to, is absolutely superb. Thank you so much for downloading this. Please leave a 5-star written review. Tell all your friends, tell all your family, and I'll see you next time. It's all right.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.